Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Uncomposed, a new podcast on the Friends in Your Head Network, where we talk about film scores with people who do,
wait for it,
film scores. Anyway, on the show this week is myself, I'm assuming as always, Tig Christie, and I'm joined by Alex Smith.
Hi.
And Kyle Newmaster.
Hey, hey.
Composers and nice gentlemen with pizza and beer. Gentlemen, hello, how are you?
Pretty good.
Fantastic.
Yeah, my name is Tig, and I play music and don't actually compose for movies or anything like that. I mean, I have before, but it's not my job. It's their job, but it's not my job. I'm just very interested in music and obviously very interested in movies and have the ability to make podcasts. So I wanted to bring all my friends that are composers in and ask them questions and talk to them about the process. And hopefully you guys find it as interesting as I do, because there's a whole other side to this filmmaking thing that we've been analyzing on this website for nigh 5 years now. And we've never even really addressed it. Who knows what's going to happen on the show writ large, but today we're going to talk sort of generally about, first of all, who these guys are, but specifically about how a film score is created so that we can build on this foundation of knowledge that they will share with us and understanding the specifics of film score and, you know, unique issues and single topics as the show continues. So, guys, thank you for joining.
You bet.
And let's see here. Kyle, what's your, give the people like a, you know, one paragraph history of your composingness. Did you start writing music in like high school before that? Were you humming songs in womb?
I always loved, you know, music in general. And I think it wasn't actually till like late high school, early college that I realized I could get into composing. Before that, I was mostly a trumpet player and a piano player. And I just started trying to do it and realized I liked it. It was just a blast being in front of people playing something that you thought up and then hearing it way, whenever anybody plays anything, it sounds better than what it looks like on paper.
Right.
I mean, it could be anything. And like, you could write anything on paper, and if you have real people playing it, it sounds great. You know, went through school, ended up getting a master's degree, moved out here about 10 years ago. I've just been scoring independent films, video games, commercials, TV stuff. Probably the majority of my bigger IMDb credits are in independent films. Recently in Microsoft Game Kinect Star Wars films that hopefully are coming out this year, like Bloodshot. Something Wicked, Channeling, hopefully,
yeah,
coming out this year.
Of course, I first heard your name on a lightsaber fight 5 or 6 years ago.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Brian versus Dorkman 2.
Those guys, man, that was they did an amazing job. It was back, what, 2006,
7, something like that?
2007, I think we scored it. Yeah, 2006, they made the film. And,
but it was a sequel to a lightsaber fight on the internet.
Yeah.
They made a bigger, better one the second time and actually were able to raise money for it and provide not only an original score that you and Gordy, who will be on the show later, wrote, but then you went to Capitol Records and actually had an orchestra perform it for the recording.
Yeah.
So it's an actual score for this internet fight video.
I would say probably that project, Ryan vs. Darkman 2, I bet you if I talk to all the people that, hey, this is what I've done, more people know about that project than any other thing I've worked on, I'm pretty sure.
You give it time, actually. But yeah, it's a cool video.
It was great. Great project. Tons of people saw it. They did great. It was a lot of fun. And luckily, you know, we got, like you said, we did get to record with a live orchestra, and that's been kind of one of my main things that kept me inspired my whole life is recording with live musicians as often as possible, which we'll talk about. Mm-hmm. So I've gotten a chance to record, you know, in London, all over the place here, Capitol Records, Warner Brothers, Sony.
We got a badass over
Fox
here.
Fox. Well, it's just a matter of like when you have a project trying to allocate the goal of recording live musicians and then doing what you can. You can't always do it. But when you can, it's just, it makes it all worth it. And so that's kind of where I came from. I don't know.
It's cool. Earlier this year, I had a chance to hear your stuff played live too, because they played the whole suite from RVD2 and then also your award-winning Star Wars Kinect music. Is that what it was?
Well, I think we were nominated for a few awards. I don't think we actually won the, did we win the award? I don't
you
think
have
we
have the Alex Smith Award because it's amazing and I love it.
Well, thanks, man. No, that score, Gordy Hobb and I co-scored Kinect Star Wars, which had, you know, mostly orchestral music and then also some dance music, and we were involved in the orchestral music, and we recorded it with the London Symphony Orchestra at Abbey Road.
Oh my God.
And the score is, you can find it on SoundCloud. You know, a lot of people have heard it, but a lot of people haven't heard it.
It's great
and
stuff.
And so if you go to SoundCloud, just put Kinect Star Wars or my name, Kindly Master or Gordy Hobb, you'll find it.
And I'm here to tell you, it sounds awesome when an orchestra's playing it right in front of you.
The cool concert you're talking about, and that's a great group that you can actually go hear them if you live in LA here. The Golden State Pops Orchestra, those guys do a ton of concerts devoted for film music and game music. And we're honored to have them play a suite of music from that game. And also they did some Old Republic music of Gordy's. And they actually did a suite of RVD2 music.
That's so cool.
Anyway, that was pretty sweet.
Kyle Newmaster,
thanks.
For the ladies.
I was freaking out over the Kinect score for a good like 2 weeks straight.
Oh, thanks,
like,
man.
Seriously, like it has quickly become one of my like go-to scores to listen to. Like,
oh, thanks, man.
It's not even, I love it, and everyone should hear it, because it's amazing.
Hi, Alex Smith. Hmm. So what's your whole deal, sir? What's your history of music? You started young, too.
I first
heard of Alex when I had just gotten out of high school, and he was, I think, still in preschool, with long hair, doing like a Steve Vai solo at the high school talent show. Yeah, and he was fully Steve Vai-ing it on stage. Yeah. It was really cool. Yeah. And like two or three really devoted 14-year-old girls were throwing things at him from both. It was wonderful. And ever since then...
I got a girlfriend that day.
Are you serious? Yeah. Are you absolutely serious?
I'm 100% serious, yes.
Oh, God.
Nothing's changed since, really.
Well, great.
Anyway, so your whole thing with music.
Yeah, I was actually listening to Kyle's story. I realized that disregarding his age and success as compared to mine and everything, but like starting out, is actually very... parallel to mine. I started out early, piano player very early on, and guitarist, went to college as a player primarily, and then about halfway through discovered that hey, I can do this, I can write music. And it wasn't quite so seamless. Long story short, for me, I had an injury that forced me to stop playing my instruments for a good year and a half.
You guitared your hand off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I Steve Vai'd
you
too much.
It. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and so I got into composing that way. But looking back, it's kind of been fate. One of my earliest memories is figuring out the John Williams Jurassic Park score, and then all through high school and everything, I was a huge Danny Elfman nut. And it's just so funny that I never put two and two together back then that maybe I could do this same thing.
Oh, this is what a calling sounds like.
Exactly. And so, yeah, there you go. So halfway through Berkeley, I
that is Berkeley College of Music.
Yes.
Not Berkeley in San Francisco, or actually, I think it's in Berkeley. But it's a music school, not Berkeley
in Boston. And I met a director, and I did his Batman film, which was a great introduction for me, because anyone who knows me knows that I'm a Batman freak. And so...
like me.
And then... And so, rest is history, I guess.
And now Hollywood and working on things.
Yeah, working on some fun stuff. So.
Welcome to California, Alex.
Yeah, thank you.
Anyway, so yeah, this is the pilot episode, and also I figured we should start somewhere near the beginning. It's a very good place to start. So let's walk Idiot Teague, the process of actually scoring a movie. I'm assuming the first thing that happens, at least until you're John Williams and you get to pick... is you're in a conversation with a director and having an idea-based conversation about sounds and all of that? Is that how this process tends to begin?
There's a spectrum. Ideally, yes. Many, and I would hesitate, but also probably wouldn't be wrong in saying that most gigs are probably more like you get hired and you want to spend a lot of time talking about the score, but you can't, and then you're rushed, and then you have to do it. In the ideal gigs, you're kind of figuring out the sonic palette and its relationship to the story, I guess. What direction, and more importantly, why are you going to go in that direction?
Basically, it depends on every gig. Every gig's a little different, and a lot of it depends on the time allotted.
Right.
You have everything from a week to 3 months, or in some cases longer. In most cases, closer to a week.
Yeah.
Probably somewhere between, more like a month to score an entire feature film. So you have to quickly come to a decision what you want to do, but more importantly, what the director wants you to do. Mm-hmm. And that's... if you've never worked with a director, it's like getting to know anybody, and also the producers, because there's lots of people involved who make the decisions on a film, figuring out what they're looking for and how to communicate that between each other. Sometimes they come from more of a musical background, and sometimes they do not, so you have to find a way to figure out what to get you to do quickly in most cases.
I was going
to
say, what does that conversation sound like? Is that a conversation that takes place referring to previous scores? Or
yeah, there's different scenarios. Sometimes they come to you and say, I've heard some of your previous music. This is the perfect situation. I've heard this.
Yeah, I'm sure Danny Elfman's had this conversation before.
Yeah. sometimes that's not a conversation you want to hear, because you might want to do something different.
Right.
But basically, if they come to you and say, hey, I've heard that you've done this, I trust you, go ahead and do what you want to do. And that's cool. But the problem with that, of course, is if then you do what you want to do, and that's not what they thought you were going to do.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's better to actually have them say, I imagine this kind of a score. Here's an example. Or in a lot of cases, they put music to the film, actually put it to the film and show you the film with previous music, not necessarily yours. Temp track. It could be Danny Elfman. It could be John Williams. It could be Hans Zimmer. It could be anybody. And have you try to emulate that with your own style. So the beginning conversation is just figuring out what you're going to do. And then, of course, also, depending on the budget of the film, what you're able to do. Because if they want you to do something with live orchestra, gigantic choir, and everything, you can do that. even on low budgets, but if they're expecting that exact same sonic result, it's difficult to do with...
So you have to like talk them down a little bit, or at least limit it. So well, with that, with the result of that, if you wanted a really great sounding orchestral recording on a limited budget, be to start removing instruments and players and have fewer players with the same recording setup, or the whole orchestra with a different recording
setup?
Well,
if in this case they're saying we want... They put in a bunch of, let's say, I don't know, Star Wars for the Tim track, and they're like, I want to sound just like that. You're going to have to say...
okay, you guys?
No. And it's simply just because, you know, you aren't going to be able to afford those musicians probably. And so in that particular case, I would say, you know, we have to resort to really good samples, sample libraries, and then
or
maybe,
get away
maybe,
with samples where you can and have real players for the stuff that you can't do in samples?
Well, I would... A general rule of thumb, of course, there aren't any... Real rules of thumb. Rule of thumb.
It's like attorneys general.
You're always going to want to try and have live players on a score. That's a good goal to generally shoot for. And in that particular case, I would say let's do like the big orchestra samples and then layer like a string quartet or something on top of that. So you get that non-completely robotic playing. And then maybe in like a really, you know, small part of the score, maybe it's something really intimate and maybe just the string quartet sounds nice. You don't want a full orchestra there. Mm-hmm. And so you can kind of use some smoke and mirrors to trick the audience into getting that same feeling as or something close to the feeling that one might get from, you know, the London Symphony Orchestra.
Well, and I think, you know, I think as far as talking about the very beginning too, because this is now we're kind of jumping past a few steps and talking more about after the composing and the actual recording.
That's a good point. Yeah.
In the very beginning, it's really this conversation that we're having right now, even just amongst ourselves, we kind of get carried away, like talking about all the possibilities because they're endless, right?
Yeah.
And so when talking to a director and a producer in the beginning, it's really all about, you know, this is what we're able to do for this project. And of course, I mean, you can bring great emotion to MIDI.
Absolutely.
Things as well.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not necessarily quicker, though. It actually might take much longer
it'll
than recording.
It'll take a while. I would say on my last score that I did, I spent more time finessing the MIDI performance than I did writing.
Yeah.
And that's
just to eke the performance out of the samples.
Yeah, you're programming these samples to sound like
you're basically
players.
Hacking a performance out of what is perfect recordings of
well,
samples.
Well, what... Really,
so the transition through notes sound better and everything else like that?
Yeah, and, you know, well, like Kyle was saying, you know, this is something that we might want to get to later in more detail, but really, yeah, these are pre-recorded recordings of players in a studio, live players, and then there's different ways that you can make them sound quieter or louder, and then you can make, you know, vibrato different, you know, all these just, different things, all the little nuances of live players, you can technically... out of a great library you can coax them out of, but it does take a long time.
Like if I were to sit and spend probably a week straight trying to recreate like one cue, really like a complicated cue. You could take a simple cue and probably if it's just a bunch of whole notes and stuff, you could probably recreate that fairly quickly to make it 85% passable. And most people could not tell the difference.
Right.
And even we might not be able to difference if we didn't really know for sure. You
right.
know what I
mean? Right.
Depending on the situation. But if you're trying to write something if you want to write something specific, very emotional or complicated or whatever that's maybe a little more involved, it just can take quite a bit of time. I think I would, like, if you took like you mentioned the 10-minute suite.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to write something that was a full 10-minute, let's say, since you said John Williams earlier, 10-minute John Williams suite.
Yeah, let's say it's a little Star Wars movie. Little 10-minute Star Wars.
That could potentially take you a month of sitting down straight, even some of the best sample people to get it to about 85%. So
to make it.
Yeah. So it's really about in the beginning, it's about, you know, back to the thing about what you do in the very beginning. It's about explaining what's possible on the budget with the amount of time they have and things like that. And so should I bring it back to that?
I was going
to
say this. Well, it's just interesting because I would have assumed that at this point, it's ultimately cheaper just to go MIDI all the way. But it sounds like what you guys are saying is, on the assumption of the same level of quality, it is cheaper to achieve that with just MIDI.
It just takes more time.
Yeah, but it takes more time. And it sounds like a viable option within a certain range of budgets would be to don't tweak the ever-living crap out of the MIDIs, get the stuff written and kind of orchestrated so that I can hear it, and we're going to take that to the orchestra and let them do
it
in a day or two.
Well, if they have the budget to hire an orchestra, that's what I generally do.
Thing is,
as opposed to spending a month tweaking every individual performance in the whole piece.
The thing is, the difference between tweaking the ever-living crap out of the MIDI and not is huge. And so
it's the difference between Nintendo and a score.
Yeah, yeah. If they don't spend too much time making the MIDI sound real. We'll layer some players on top of it. What it's going to sound like is a couple live players.
Well, yeah,
layered
you're
on top
talking
of
about you're crap. Talking about adding on top. Though I'm talking about
right.
replacing.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah.
If you're adding on top of the MIDI with like if you're going to do MIDI strings with the flute solo and or a couple of other violins on top or something, then you got to make the MIDI sound.
Oh yeah, I mean using MIDI almost as like the same way I imagine a lot of how John Williams would explain a score to Spielberg or Lucas was he'd sit down at the piano, do a little piano sketch in front of him. The MIDI equivalent of that, where it's like it's going to be this sort of thing. Get the orchestration done in MIDI because that's faster than anything else, but don't spend all your time afterwards trying to make that the performance. Just do that so I can kind of hear where you're going with it, and we'll take those sheets in to record it.
That's an interesting point. That would be nice if that were the case, but actually,
directors don't hear through the MIDI.
Yeah, they most times they don't. And you know, you can't blame them for it. If I were saying Teague, make this VFX shot for me, and you go, this is what it's going to be better than this. I'm going to be like, well, I can't know what it's going to look like because
well, that's where
and of course I would have to imagine, and of course because I go through the same process, I could work with that. But
right.
But a director, if you give them great writing, like objectively great writing, where like composers would all come around, they'd be like, man, you're an amazing composer, and and the MIDI performance is just awful.
It sounds a little Final Countdown.
If you just kind of like, you know, just pooped it out one night and then the director's coming over and he's checking it out, director probably wouldn't like the cue. And the thing is, he probably wouldn't know why. And it would usually be because of that. And one thing that I've noticed is actually many times people respond to the production quality of my music as opposed to the writing quality. They might say like,
God, that sounds real.
Yeah, exactly. That is generally the first comment that I get.
Is it real? Or is it usually MIDI?
No, I have not had the opportunity to record live players on any projects yet.
Oh shit.
On any scores.
Yeah. Some of your stuff sounds really real.
Yeah.
Well, the stuff that I've heard, I don't mean like of the stuff I've heard, two or three of them sounded real. The stuff that I've heard all sounded legit.
Yeah.
Well done.
Well, thanks.
But, Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a lot of time and a lot of, you know, tearing your hair out to make it like that. And it's a great skill for someone in my position to learn because, like I was just saying, you have to be able to do that to even just present cues to directors because they might not know what exactly they don't like about it. If the MIDI performance isn't real, they might just be like, oh, there's something off here. And if you had spent the extra hour, you know, tweaking it.
And that actually goes back to something prior to the step where
I was
going
to say, we need to get back to the part where we compose a score.
But that actually is a point that goes prior to that, getting the gig. We're going to jump back to actually what happens. But getting the gig, it's all about having something that sounds the most compelling, right? And if here goes a...
They found me. I don't know how, but they found me.
Run for it, Marty! But yeah, it comes back to, you know, when you're going for a gig, if they're like, hey, I'm going to have five composers compose, a lot of times this happens, you know, here's a scene, or I just need you to write something that's 3 minutes long, or score this 5-minute scene, and we're going to have five of you do it. You know, if
it's
you might
shootout,
write the
basically.
Most complicated music or the most, you know, the most emotional, the picture, but if your demo doesn't sound the most convincing production-wise, they might pick the demo that just sounds like, oh, that actually sounds like something I might hear at a movie, you know? And so what I'm getting at is that the production quality of what you can do with your setup,
in terms of demonstration,
you know, with your samples and your chops with, you know, EQs and reverbs and just what you've got, that's actually as important as composing to get the gig.
Right. And production quality and writing are now completely intertwined. And it's two points that you could make about this. One is that a lot of people will kind of like blame the technology. They might just be like, oh man, now we have to spend all this time doing this, or, you know, I wish I didn't have to. And thing is that it's really not MIDI's fault. It is, you know, if you had the opportunity to have access to an orchestra at all times, hypothetically, which would be great. And you're trying to get this hypothetical gig that Kyle proposed. The equivalent would be if you, the equivalent to the bad MIDI would be if you were in a crappy sounding room and you told your players to play with as little emotion as possible, then that's kind of what we'd be getting in. So again, it's not necessarily like
you're just doing your directing, you know, behind the desk as opposed to from the
it's basically
podium.
yeah with MIDI conducting is really, really long. It takes a long time. it's slow motion conducting. Yeah, and I was going to make another point and I completely forgot what it
you
was.
You were saying writing and production are intertwined.
Oh, right. And another thing to consider, and this is also kind of like stepping ahead a little bit, but it's on my mind.
I'll bring us back to writing here in a second.
An interesting point that this affects writing in a very unconscious way, and I think it is detrimental. And this is something where I think maybe possibly you could kind of blame technology for possibly hurting the music. Samples are limited. You know, I mean, we know this. It you can only do a finite amount of things with a solo violin sample. There's only so many things that it was programmed to do. And with a live player, you could go so far as to say, hey, go crash your instrument against the wall. I mean, you can do anything. There are no limits with a live player.
It's a person who knows how to play an instrument in front of a microphone.
Right. And so what those samples are able to do, or more importantly, not do, can affect your music without you really knowing. I was reading this great article a little while ago that was saying maybe one of the reasons why so many scores nowadays are so focused on the low strings is because low strings
sound good.
Generally sound better than high strings in most samples.
That's actually my main pet peeve with the majority of film music nowadays. Not the best scores and stuff like that, but the majority of it is pretty stale.
Yeah.
I would say 50% at least, and that's probably being generous. It's pretty stale.
I don't want to drop names, but I know I have a name in my head, and I think everyone else does too.
I'm not going to throw any names out there, but I'm just going to say, like, and I think it kind of goes to that point of if you're going to write orchestral music, I think you have to understand the orchestra. And I think,
precisely.
And I think you have to have written for actual orchestra to mock up. So even if you are going to go to, like, working just with MIDI, I think you have to have at least invested a significant amount of time in listening to live orchestras, not just film scores, like
going to
classical
see them
music,
live,
going to see them live,
studying scores,
talking to them, not necessarily going to school. That's a good way to do it.
Because being absent of all those conventions is more detrimental than understanding why the conventions
are
there.
If you're going to sit at a computer and try to emulate, I mean, I guess this is different for music than a lot of other things when you're sitting at a computer and coming up with stuff that you're coming out of your head, but
a facsimile.
But you know, but because with effects, you're coming up with things that probably don't happen in a lot of cases, and or sometimes, you know what I mean. But with music, you're trying to recreate something that actually happens, and so in order to do that, I think you have to actually know how it sounds when it actually does happen.
Right.
You know, so
you have to know the limitations of the instruments as well. And let me just to prove a point. The one time that I've been able to record an orchestra with my own music, which by the way was amazing. That is some of the best writing orchestration I personally think that I've ever done, and I wrote it without using samples. I used pencil and paper.
Just in your head?
Well, yeah, I mean a piano and pencil and paper. And it's because I was, instead of, you know, kind of, I don't want to say shortcut, but it kind of is, I wasn't relying on the deception of these great sounds coming out of my speakers. Instead, I was having to think, what can these instruments do? Where would this melody best be placed? You know, all these things. This whole orchestration is a giant, giant thing that we really shouldn't get into. But the whole point is that my best music was done without samples. And of course, it took way longer, though. I mean, it was that was a piece that took an entire semester to write.
But that was also because it's one of the first times you actually did that. I think if you were able, you know, hopefully in the future you'll be able to do that where that's a regular thing.
Right.
You'll learn a lot from that first time of doing that. But what you probably found is like you didn't have to worry. Once it was done, the music was there. It was realized on paper.
Right.
And you sat in front of them. It was all about just making sure you had the right people in front of you.
Right.
And getting to perform. Then you are kind of like a director because it's like really just telling them, like kind of pushing them or trying to inspire them to move in a certain direction emotionally and musically, and then it's more
urgency in the strings,
and not so much about sitting there going, that sample is just like, it just doesn't have, you know, the right, it doesn't have this or that or whatever. It doesn't, you know, you don't have to go and find 25 different samples and combine them to be able to get what one person can do in 20 seconds live. So it's about money, you know, can you get those people? And also, there is a sound that is MIDI which is preferable in some situations. You know, yeah. It does add, I found myself taking live recordings where it was played great, but not recorded the way I wanted necessarily, mm-hmm. and added MIDI because it just didn't have the presence there that I'm used to, or the directors are used to, that MIDI brings, which is very, a lot of times, upfront mm-hmm. and punchy, which live sometimes is not, you know.
Right, right.
So, but anyway, we can right. we can keep talking about that.
So
but
let's go back. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, sorry.
I was going to kick us off back on the writing direction thing here. All right, so let's say you're dealing with a director. He's got, I don't know, $5,000. He wants a four-minute piece of music, and he's temp tracked it with the Tatooine Two Sons theme. Dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun, dun. Oh, man. There's actually one good MIDI sample for that kind of thing.
Is it a French horn?
Yeah, it's a French horn viola sample with Symphobia. That's pretty good. Yeah, you know that one?
Oh, yeah.
So a director is like, okay, I've got $5,000 and you got 2 weeks and it's just a 4 minute piece. But that's what he's tempted with, and he's got kind of a case of temp love. He doesn't want you to emulate it. He's not saying recreate it, but you know, it's this process. You have to write it. Like, okay, got it. You know what he wants. He wants the temp track. What do you do first?
Well, what's going on screen?
Let's say it's, for the purposes of demonstration, this isn't what he asked for, but for the purposes of this conversation, let's say it's the scene in Star Wars, where he's coming out in those emotions, and it's that scene, it's those beats.
Well,
say George Lucas came to you with that scene, and it was temp-tracked with the actual score to it. But you see what I'm saying? Like, you put pen to paper at some point, what's the first thing you start writing down? Or do you sit at a piano and start fiddling up with a melody?
I think it's probably different for both of us. So,
man, and also, you know, it depends on the project too, and it depends on the exact. I mean, yeah, the question.
This is the most annoying siren-y episode of anything we've ever recorded. Oh, anyway, sorry, Alex.
Well, I mean, the problem with how, you know, questions regarding writing is that I have a very hard time answering those because there's still no actual process for me. It is every single time. It feels like, oh God,
I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah, I forgot how to write.
Yeah, absolutely. And, every composer will tell you that. Yeah, you forget how to write after everything you write.
Yeah, and so. Yeah, Danny Elfman is well known for saying that. So yeah, I mean, I don't really know how to answer that.
Jesus, fire truck now. Okay,
something big going on.
Sorry. Anyway,
there.
Kyle, what about you? How would you approach that scenario?
Well, let's wait till that one.
Well, let me ask you about this. A more isolated question first.
Guys, OJ's back.
When someone tells... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, good. No, I was going to say, before we even get into the esoteric things about that, should we just do a rundown of, like, the actual, like, this, and this happened in a film, you think? I'll finish this, and then we'll do that or something. Or not.
Let's do that in a second. We'll do that in a second. For right now, back on the thingy with the Twin Sons theme here.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. When someone plays you the temp track, what do you hear? What do you, I mean, I assume you have a conversation with them to figure out what it is you love about this. But
yeah.
Yes.
In that case, remember, it's temp tracked with the lone sort of French horn that gets the mm-hmm. swell of strings under it. Are you hearing French horn? Are you hearing sad? Are you hearing orchestra?
Probably. Yeah. I mean, all of it. I mean, basically, if you're talking about temp track, when you hear a temp track, again, going back to what the director's looking for, try to decide what is a director looking for. So if I was looking at that scene in Star Wars and hearing that, I would have to analyze, okay, does he like the actual piece itself, you know, and how it interacts to what, you know,
like
in that case, Luke is doing, and the fact that it starts out small, you know, with just, you know, solo, like
a lone voice,
you know, or is it that, like, does he or she, the director, like the sparseness of the orcs are there, or do they like, you know, the fact that it's orchestral, or they like that it's, you know, a specific key, they like it's a specific instrument? Is there a lot of things you have to figure out? Because it might be you think that they think that it's that specific orchestral sound, but might actually just be...
No, they just love French horns.
Yeah, they just really played French horn in high school. Or you know, that it... The fact that the note jumps up, you know, a lot of John Williams music, it leaps up a lot. It might mm-hmm. be that. Or it could be a lot of different things. So it's really figuring out in the very beginning what it is that they like about that temp track.
Yeah, I would add that generally one should try and stray away from... specific, you know, if you're asking the director, what do you like about this? One should generally stray away from specific musical questions and instead say, you know, what should the audience be feeling? You know, like, what should the music be adding here? You know, like, if you get too musical, it can get very bogged down. So if I was given that scene, Jesus,
By the way, John Williams will be listening to this podcast. Yeah,
I wonder what it was temped with. I mean, if it was, because I think a lot of that score was...
He did a lot of... He temped with a lot of Holst, if I think.
It was almost all the planets.
So I wonder what was temped there.
Is it which one begins with that? It sounds very similar. Maybe Venus? One of them begins with that sort of thing.
Venus, the first phrase, there's a French horn and Venus that the first half of the phrase...
And it's a similar
Venus
interval, too.
Same.
I think it's a fourth.
No, it's the same. It's dun, 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 dun. Dun, and then it goes somewhere else.
Right.
Probably
was it then.
By the way, if you like John Williams and somehow haven't heard The Planet Suite by Gustav Holst, yeah, just go to YouTube and type in The Planet Suite, press play. And I swear to God, you'll enjoy the next 50 minutes.
And listen to the one conducted by Leonard Bernstein.
Ooh.
This general
just saying
rule of thumb for classical music. If you find something conducted by Leonard Bernstein, it's going to be good.
No, we're all bros with Holst. Holst was going to be here today, but he died.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay, so you've narrowed it down, and you know, so okay, this guy with the beard and the glasses, he likes himself this sort of French horny sound. I mean, I don't want to get too obvious about it, or just categorize everything together. But do you just start with like, I need a melody to hang everything else on?
This question is so tough to answer. I think it goes back to the very beginning of like when you started in music, what got you excited, mm-hmm. what you hear with anything you play.
Uh-huh.
I know, Alex, you started on guitar, right? I started
Piano.
On piano, so did I. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I went to trumpet. And so for me, a lot of it is I used to sit down even as a kid and just come up with random stuff on the piano just mm-hmm. for fun long before I thought I would get into composing. Mm-hmm. And on trumpet, too, same thing. I would just sit with an emotion. Like I'd be sad and I'd be pissed off at somebody or whatever. I'd just go, and I had a teacher tell me once, go play that on your instrument. And so that was one of those valuable
things. Wow, what a great prompt.
It was one of the best things I've ever been taught, actually. It's just when I felt pissed off or like happy or sad or like, you know, in love or whatever, like sit down and play it on the
instrument. Make the instrument feel like you do.
Yeah, and so I think when I compose, whatever the emotion is I'm going for, I take all of those things along with all the excitement, experimentation of when I first started, you know, and try to bring that. It's just some weird thing. You just have to re-inspire yourself every time.
Yeah.
And so for me, a lot of times I just go like, honestly, I just go like lay down mm-hmm. and almost go to sleep, but not quite. Or I go drive around. I think of a lot of stuff driving.
Yeah.
Which maybe isn't the safest thing in the world, but
I'm going to guess that John Williams wrote The Trench Run while driving in LA.
Yeah. I mean, iPhones are great now for that, you know, or anything. You just go get, you know, iTalk or anything and think of an idea, you pull over, sing it into it. You know,
if Danny Elfman had an iPhone, that's exactly how Batman would have been written.
Yeah.
Except he did it in a bathroom of a plane, if I recall correctly. Like writing down, he wrote down like the phrase on like a napkin in the bathroom of the airplane.
Oh yeah.
Dun, 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 dun.
Yep.
If he had an iPhone, he would have done exactly what you're talking about.
And the second you're inspired, you have to write it down. Like,
you have
I'm sure
to.
You have this sometimes too. You'll be thinking of random stuff over and over and kind of going through, kind of like we were with the titles for the show. We were trying to think of ideas. You got to write it down because you might think of the great one that's going to be the one.
Oh, I'm not going to forget that. I promise I won't forget that. And then 3 seconds later, oh shit.
Yeah,
what was it? It was
so
good.
Stuff. Like, I mean, I'm sure you've had this where you think of an entire piece and then you go to sleep. And then you can't remember it the next day. So
like, sighing so hard thinking about just the ones that got away. I just know that they were good.
You just got it. The second you're inspired, you got to write it down, sing it into a recording, something. And so same thing when you're writing, I think, you know, it depends also back to that. Like, is there a time limit or is it open-ended? Because if it's open-ended, sometimes that can take a lot longer because you're going to wait for the perfect idea to come across, right?
Yeah, two weeks.
You just got to start going and start writing. But if it's like a time limit and you have to have like a 2-minute piece written in the next 3 hours, you just got to throw all, like kind of like the Kinect score, we had 6 weeks to write 120 minutes, you know.
That was done in 6 weeks?
The writing.
Oh,
yeah.
Jesus Christ.
So that's what I'm saying. Like, but basically you wake up we woke up every day. And I didn't want to wake up and write something after 20-hour writing day the night before, you know, and have to write another 2-minute piece that was an action 2-minute piece, right?
Goodness.
But you wake up and you have to, or you will not finish and get paid, you know. So the question is, are you going to wait for inspiration or are you going to force inspiration? Mm-hmm. And so I think the forced inspiration, you just kind of go back to your bag of tricks
mm-hmm.
and you hope that something hits you at the last second that's totally new and exciting. But if not, you go to what you know you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when you're in the middle of doing what you know you can do, you get inspired. So you just got to go. But when you have endless time and you can just be inspired, personally, I just, you know, or in the beginning, in the beginning of a project, before it gets crazy with schedules and I'm stressed out and stuff about finishing,
that's when I go drive around, lay down, think about stuff, record things. A lot of times I record everything, or if I go back and finish a project and I look at my initial notes of what I wrote down or what I recorded in my phone, 80% of what I wrote on that score is from my initial ideas, because that's when I was relaxed and inspired and things like that.
That's cool.
So I don't know. Is that how you do
it? Yeah. There's some similarities. Yeah. It's funny when you said the initial notes and stuff. I was actually just recently looking back at the initial notes from a score that I did, and none of that made it into the score.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was you know, fairly fleshed out ideas, and we threw away all of them. It was the right choice, but, I'd completely forgotten about them, and I was so glad that I did, but that's one of those things that happens, is that, you know, you might be doing something and, you know, you've gone a little ways into it, and you and the director each realize, like, this is not it. This isn't right.
We don't even have time to go into this question very long. This could be an hour-long episode question here, but I think a lot of people, myself included, me less, I get it more now than I used to, but a lot of people would be curious. The difference between writing a song on your guitar and writing a song with 80 people to play it for you, they would ask you, what's the order of operations from going from, okay, I know what that dude with the little string instrument is playing, I know what all 80 of them are playing and how they interact with each other. How do you go from one to the full orchestration and counterpoint and everything?
You don't write it for 80 people, you write it for sections.
Yeah, it's absolutely. Even a full orchestra with 80 people, there might be four or five things going on.
Right.
You know, and subtleties, texture-wise, and like it's all about subtleties, you know, but there's probably a melody, a counterpoint, a couple, you know, the harmonic ideas going on, the
background,
rhythm,
middle ground,
you know, really. And if you get like, I remember when I was first checking out a ton of classical stuff, and I remember hearing Schoenberg, all I had heard about Schoenberg when I was first starting out was all this, you know, 12 tone stuff and all that. But I can't remember specific names of pieces right now, but when I went back and checked out the stuff before he went 12 tone, I remember thinking, that stuff that he was writing, the fully romantic orchestral stuff, it was really incredibly crafted, but there was so much going on. It was obvious that he just got bored.
Yeah.
Because he could do so much, but there was so much going on. And I feel that way sometimes writing orchestral music. It's like, you have to limit yourself, because if you're trying to do like, oh, I'm going to add one more level of something and this other thing, and it's like, if the listener has too many things to listen to, they can't grasp on anything. So if... You know, even though you have 80 people playing it, there might only be 2, 3, 4 things going on. And so it's not actually that much more complicated than if you sat down with your guitar and played a melody and played a harmony part and a rhythm part. It's not really, if you did that and orchestrated it out for orchestra, it's just that there's a lot of people playing those three parts.
Right. And, you know, I have two funny little things about that point. When I was at Berkeley, there was a point when I was guilty of throwing in way too much into each piece, and it hit me so hard. But there's this fantastic teacher who he's going to be one of those guys that I will never forget. And at one point he just looked at me, he's like, you're going to write again. This isn't the only thing you're ever going to write. Like you don't have to throw in everything into just one thing. And that was big for me. And then the other thing is, I think of this quote almost every day, I think. And it's a John Mayer quote, but I don't remember the exact words. But the idea is that when you're writing, it's kind of like when you're in kindergarten or whatever. You put glue on a paper plate and then you like sprinkles and stuff onto it. And then you shake off the stuff that doesn't stick.
Yeah.
And he's like, that is the most important step in writing. Yeah. You know, you can be creative. You can throw all you want at it. But eventually you have to shake it off, and some things just aren't going to stick.
Definitely. When you're writing.
It's huge.
When you're writing music, and you, good thing is nowadays we, a little bit back to technology, we have programs even before we do our MIDI mockups. Like if you're writing even just for a live group and you have Finale even, let's say, and you're writing it Finale or Sibelius.
Which for the people that don't know, those are notation programs.
We haven't even explained MIDI. We'll get to that in a second. But basically if you, if you're writing into a program, you can hear it back, and it's going to sound a lot better with live musicians, but you can tell if there's too much going on.
Right. Absolutely.
Know? But ultimately, if you can't hear it in your head, in my opinion, if you can't imagine it, if you can't think of it, even if maybe you can't imagine it up front, but after you've started writing it, if you can't look at it and hear it in your head, it's probably too complicated.
For me, if I'm not humming it all the time, it's not good enough.
And I'm not saying you need to be able to look at a note on paper and go, like, sing that note.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm talking about just, like, kind of imagine the general story. If you can, like, if I can't play a piece, if I can't really play a piece back over and over in my head, I don't think it's good.
Yeah.
For me,
for that same theme where we had thrown away a bunch of stuff, that same movie where we came back and started from scratch. The theme that I came up with, I could not stop humming it. And that was when I knew, I was like, this is right. This is the right one for this.
Now, the other hand, though, we're talking like basic ideas. You're going to discover things when it's especially if it's played live. That's the difference between playing live and MIDI, is because you hear it instantly with MIDI and you craft it until it sounds the way you want it to be. Playing live,
there's accidents.
You try things sometimes with specific, you know, like you take a violin player. They can, you know, especially with multiple violin players, there's this subtleties in the sound that they can do with all the different types of bowings and the harmonics and the different types of things they can do. It's just so crazy how many different things they can do. And that goes for every instrument. So you're going to learn things, and that's what a good orchestrator will do, you know, help you figure out those things to bring that out of your composition. So I'm not saying you need to be able to hear all of that, although the better you get, the more you hear.
Sure.
But I think in general, compositionally, like,
The basic ideas.
The basic melody, rhythm, at least melody and rhythm and maybe sort of harmony. If you can't imagine it, it's probably too complicated.
Though, and a funny point on that, I remember very early on in the podcast, you said something to the effect of...
talking about this one or the last one?
This one. and I bookmarked it in my head. And shit, what did you even say? And now I'm drawing a blank. This beer, god damn it. Point that I was going to make, though, is regardless of whatever you said, fuck what you said. So the point is that you sometimes, you know, for me, the experience for me a lot of the time is that I might hear something in my head and it will never, ever, ever, ever be as good as it was in my head. You know, there's this point in writing. I know that writers of the English language have this exact same thing, where you have this idea going on in your head. You're like, oh man, this is great. And the moment that you introduce it to the real world, even if you're doing a really great reproduction of what was in your head, if you're, you know, I'm hearing the violins doing this and all of that, you can get to a point where it's just it's just not as good. You ever run into that?
Yeah, of course. Definitely. I mean, you're always striving, you know, for something greater.
To reach
you know?
What you're, yeah.
One point I think that I made, maybe it was what you're talking about, maybe not, that I wanted to elaborate on, was just the more you listen to anything, the more tools you're going to have. So, you know, back when you wanted to be a Steve Vai guitar player way back in the day, maybe you still do, you know?
Wanted to be, sir.
Well,
no.
You probably was. You already are. Right?
No. It happened on stage. It was gross.
You didn't get that by listening to a bunch of ragtime piano, right? Yeah, you listen to a bunch of guitar like that.
Right,
so
right.
I think if you're going to want to write orchestral music, you got to go out there and listen to a bunch of work, a lot of orchestral music.
You have to be kind of disgustingly obsessed with...
Yeah, and not just like I wanna, not just like that might be cool if I also did a little bit of that. I mean, like, you gotta.
It has to move you very deeply.
Yeah, so.
It has to be something that you truly, really.
You have to
care
see more
about.
Possibilities in orchestral than you see in other types of music.
Yeah. It has to be the type of music that you go to.
You find the most expressive.
Yes.
If you don't like it, what's the point in writing it? You know what I mean? Like, I don't.
That's a funny point to make, but it's so true. There's definitely a lot of students during my time at Berklee where. There's a
fair
lot of
weather
people,
orchestral fans.
Yeah, or there's a lot of fair weather composers that I met early on, and I'm sure that there's
okay.
A
seriously,
lot.
Did one of you kill someone,
guys?
Are they gonna hear this on the playback?
I think they are.
This didn't
like I said, OJ's back, man.
You're talking students.
I'm sure almost in every career there's the exact same thing, but there were a lot of composers that I met, or composers, and they we'd start talking composers, and they wouldn't like any.
But here's the thing: they might really love music, but maybe they need to write the music they love,
sure,
and not just write, you know, what they think they're supposed to write.
Sure,
you know what
That's
I mean?
A good point.
Yeah.
There's a lot of film scoring going on, and I'm not going to go specifically right now because we don't have a ton of time. But there's a lot of film scoring I love, but there's a lot that I don't love. And if film scoring moves to a place that I don't like, I don't know if I'll want to write film scores like that. So if you don't like something, why get involved doing it? You have to be inspired in the first place. So that's what I'm getting at with orchestral music. I think in order to understand like how to get the most out of a live orchestra or live musicians, you have to have really invested like years, years, not necessarily years in school, but that helps, of course. But
years of attention.
Years with your nose in a scorebook.
Yes. Yeah. You can easily sit down with a, if you sat down with a score and recordings, whether it be film scores or you know, classical pieces or, you know, going to orchestra hall or whatever, and just studied and said, instead of just hearing something and saying, oh, that's cool, like going to figure out why it's cool. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a teacher used to say, don't be wow oriented. In other words, like, don't just be like, wow. Like, if you say wow, go figure out why you said wow.
Yep.
You know, and so you have to like invest a lot of time into that. And if you do that with orchestra music, you're probably going to have more tools when you sit down with nothing in your head to write. And you have to imagine the orchestra. You're going to have more to draw upon than if you've only heard two film scores that you thought were cool. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's what I'm getting at. It's like when you sit down and you write music, you have to have a lot to draw upon. Like I might not be able to sit down.
Like fluently imagine an orchestra in your head.
Yeah. Like, I don't know, pick a random style that I probably don't know very much about.
Bebop.
I actually know a lot about bebop.
Yeah, he's a trumpet player. Come on.
Dubstep.
I know fair amount because of film scoring, but I don't consider myself a DJ or anything like that. That would be so. Yeah, if I sat down, and you said, "Kyle, you're the guy. We heard you're the dubstep guy." You know,
we've all heard that.
You know, and you said, well, "You're the guy. You're apparently the expert."
At least you look like the dubstep
guy. I've got
guy.
Like that.
Kyle X.
I've got that. I've got that track I heard on a couple commercials, the two that I knocked off for a couple of trailer cues, and some others, and the stuff I've heard on the radio. But I haven't invested in all the independent film. I mean, not film, independent artists and things like that. And I don't know, like, you know, underground people doing it. So that's what I'm saying. With anything you're doing, you have to be passionate about it.
Mm-hmm.
But if I get hired for a dubstep score, don't make fun of me.
I guess now's a good
point. I can dig dubstep.
Now is a good point to point out that orchestral music and film music are not synonymous.
No, yeah, absolutely not. That's what, not. Yeah, like, that's why I think if you're real about what you're writing, I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what I like about, I'm going to mess up with John Bryant, his scores that are kind of orchestral, kind of quirky, kind of weird. You know, like, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Oh,
okay.
What was the one with Adam Sandler? What was really dark?
Punch Drunk Love.
Punch Drunk Love. Some of those
Eternal Sunshine had a great score.
Yeah, I think he did that one. But he does like really quirky, weird. They have orchestra, but they're inspired by his
thing. It's spacier. It's a little bit.
It's not orchestra. And I'm okay if you don't write traditional orchestral music if you're inspired and it's obviously like something you'd love.
Yeah.
Okay, so wait, let's get back to the thing here. We got to bring this in for a landing. So
sorry, man.
You've just written some real good shit. Is this the point wherein you bring in an orchestrator to help you get it ready for recording? Or do you skip that step? And
an orchestrator is an interesting job, and they play an interesting role, and it changes from project to project.
It's the producer of music.
It could be, they can play. They can wear a lot of hats. And what might happen is, you know, let's say Danny Elfman's very earliest parts of his career, he wasn't really an orchestrator. He didn't know really how to orchestrate his music. Not to say that he wasn't a brilliant writer, but actually, you know, saying where to put.
Let me ask you this. An orchestrator, a very good orchestrator, has the skill of blank. The particular skill of blank.
Hmm.
Taking at the very, like, the most, like, maximum expression of the job would be, like, a composer writes something on piano and then they turn it into, they explode then to orchestra. Nowadays that an orchestrator could also be doing something as minimal as they receive the MIDI files from the composer. And the composer is like said, you know, like they've already recorded, like flute is going here. They're playing this, strings are doing this. And what might happen is, they get those files and they load it into a notation program for all the real players to see. And they might add some stuff here and there.
Like a flourish or a run
or something? Yeah, like maybe let's say that, in like a big action cue, you might have these like little flute flourishes. Those little quick things. And it might just be a little bit too much detail for the composer to figure out, but they're each on the same page. Like he might even say like, think of these flute flourishes as being from the pod racing scene. You know, they might say that and then the orchestrator will actually figure out the exact notes and But they each know the effect that they're going on. It's not that the composer isn't able to do it. It's just that, you know, it might be like, what key are we in? What can the flute not do? A lot of woodwinds have some weird little
things
in
between notes.
That's
interesting, because earlier I made a joke about producers, but it seems like the closest analog, of which there are no good close analogs, would be if the composer is the director, the orchestrator is pretty much the cinematographer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
That's actually not bad.
That's good. Yeah. I've never heard that, but yeah.
In terms
good.
Of the director yeah. says, it yep. needs to feel like this.
It depends on the composer orchestrator yeah. you're talking about. Like, you take, like, John Williams, he pretty much is all of those, and the orchestrator is sort of like, it'll be like as if the director actually shot the picture in his case.
Right.
And,
right.
You know,
he's the Soderbergh. He's the Soderbergh of composers.
And yeah, I mean, I don't, it's just, it depends on the person. You know, like, yeah. I've heard of some orchestrators who actually were basically given a major chord and said, hey, make this like develop and be really cool. You know what I mean? And it's like, but
turn these notes into a cue.
Yeah, basically. But in most cases is what Alex was talking about.
We need a 2-minute cue. It's C major. Have fun.
Yeah.
Seriously. Right. But in most cases, it's like what Alex was talking about, where it's a good relationship and the composer totally understands what's going on, but doesn't have time to fully figure it out. And hopefully if you're hiring an orchestrator, it's for one of two reasons. It's because you don't have time to orchestrate yourself, or because you're hiring somebody that brings something to the table that
right.
you, because you know, somebody that loves orchestrating is gonna understand the orchestra like we're talking about.
Yeah,
you know?
And let's
someone
say
who speaks
that,
orchestra.
Let's yeah. say that the composer is, you know, he's coming at it from like he was a rocker for a long time, and he just kind of like fell backwards into film scoring, and he just has a great
is he wearing
sense.
A beanie hat and sitting on my couch?
Yes. But no, he has a great.
Is that a beanie hat?
I don't know.
I guess. I don't know.
No, it doesn't have a propeller on it, but it yeah. should.
Huh. It's the Andy Rumschlag hat.
Oh my God, it is.
It is, right?
Anyway. It's a stylish
yeah,
hat,
so,
you guys.
Yeah, so there you go.
Radio theater. My top hat is very impressive.
But,
okay, we're not on camera. Okay.
So, so like this composer, though, he might have an amazing sense of what works dramatically. Actually, Danny Elfman, there you go. I mean, his early career was that. He knew exactly
yeah,
what needed
Elfman
to be there.
Here.
But he needed someone who actually
spoke orchestra.
Yeah, someone who like really knew it. Because a lot of things, something that people don't necessarily consider if they don't understand orchestration is that when you bring all these live instruments together, it's kind of a chaotic atmosphere in the sense that a lot of instrument, like X instrument is good at something, Y instrument is good at something else, and they aren't really good at existing in the same
space.
Yeah. For example, the very opening Star Wars theme, main titles, are in the key of B flat because he is murdering his trumpets, and that is the key where they are the most comfortable. That is my guess. And
it's in B flat because the 20th Century Fox fanfare is in B flat. I'm not kidding.
Oh, that's why. Okay, well, then it was a very, very
nice
coincidence.
It might have been the trumpet thing that sounds more like something John Williams would have thought of.
Yeah.
But I've always heard, and it might be apocryphal, that it's written so that there's a continuity between the sounds of the dun ba da dun 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 boom, and then you hear bum ba da dun.
Yeah. But anyways, like violins, I mean, they don't hate it, but they don't love playing in the key of B flat, but trumpets, that's their most comfortable key. And so
we'll talk about concert tuning later.
So yeah,
I have so many questions.
Yeah. And so
it makes no sense.
Yeah. So there's those sorts of things that you need. You know, the composer, he might not have any idea. He might be writing out of the instrument's range. He might not even know it.
Yeah.
But the thing is, he might know exactly what needs
Danny
to be.
Danny Elfman accidentally wrote the French horn off the map. Go get it.
And the thing is, the orchestrator might not be a dramatic writer. They might truly just be. They might be an orchestral technician, so to speak. You know.
The librarian of sound.
Yeah, and the thing is, that's just one example, and it's a very, there's a million different ways.
Yeah,
that,
but we could have
exists.
A 3-hour talk just on our, you could actually, with the, Penka, who you're working with right now,
right.
You could have an orchestration talk. I mean, we could have an orchestration talk, but I've said that, like, that's what
she's
done a lot of, but it's a extremely deep topic.
Yeah.
That's different for every person. And every
I'm looking forward to this one. I'm looking forward to that episode, to be honest.
I'd love to check that out, too. It's such a cool topic, and you know, there's so many limitations there and also possibilities with every instrument that you have to know about all of it. So,
that's one of the reasons why I love writing for orchestra, and why I would guess one of the reasons why you love writing for orchestra is because there are all these limitations, but there's so much you can do. There's so much left to do with an orchestra.
It's a big ass backyard.
You know? Yes, exactly.
I mean, like, give me an example.
Are my analogies ever helpful?
They're always so good.
Like, seriously. A simple little thing you wouldn't think of, like, this is kind of a
dumb little thing, but I was just writing, I'm a trumpet player, so I was just writing a trumpet piece. And I know a lot about the trumpet because I play trumpet.
Right.
And I was asked to write a trumpet quintet for this ITG guild, Trumpet Guild conference thing coming up.
Cool.
So I wrote this thing. And even though I play the trumpet, I'm writing it, I'm imagining it. And then I actually played it so they could hear it too. I recorded it. And as I was playing, I was like, oh, that's not that easy. I actually had to change stuff after I wrote it, even though I play trumpet. Like, I was like, wow, that's actually not all that playable.
So I do that all the time on guitar.
Yeah, it's like, it's just, you have to know a lot about the instrument. Even if you know a lot about the instrument, there's still going to be things you have to go to the players and ask them questions sometimes. And I don't know, I do that on pieces I'm doing. Like, I might set up a meeting with a violin player and be like, hey, how does this look? Are these bowings okay? Can you help me make sure this goes smooth?
Mm-hmm. And ideally, an orchestrator will be someone who already has those answers for you and can go.
Or at the very least,
or at least help you.
Point you in the right direction.
They've hopefully it's not their first rodeo. Yeah. You know, like they've done it a few times and they're like, they'll just look at it and be like, that won't work. Orchestrators, in this, you know, sort of academic sense that we're thinking about them, which again is just one of many ways that they can exist. But orchestrators, I have noticed, do tend to be teachers. I remember at Berkeley, there's a lot of guys who have had orchestration careers, not necessarily composing. They are composers, absolutely, but they've made their whole thing as an orchestrator, and they also just happen to teach music. Because it is, you know, many times it can be kind of like, here's this music and now make it just better, you know. It's kind of like an arranger in a way.
Interesting.
You know, there's definitely an overlap.
Should we do some sort of like a this happens all the way through the whole process, you think?
Yeah, let's do that.
I'll give you my ABCs, tell me if I forget something. Basically, you audition for the gig, whatever that is, get the gig, it's communications director, then basically write the music with constant feedback. Tweaking things along the way with demos along the way, giving demos and getting them signed off on each piece of music, you know, anything from 10 minutes to 2 hours of music, right? After you're finished writing the score, you would then record the score if you're going to record live. And that could mean either just fixing up your MIDI stuff, your synthesize. MIDI, by the way, is, we haven't even actually
musical instrument, digital interface.
It's basically just the we're talking about synthesizer music, you know, anything that's not that you're doing through your keyboard, that's through the computer, that
realistic sounds but on a synth.
So, you know, after you've written it, you're basically just tweaking that up, making sure everything sounds perfect, and that could be recording live or making your MIDI sound better. Then after that, and you finish it, everybody signs off on it, director, producer, then you, of course, orchestration is in there if you go live.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole other
point.
We skipped a couple steps if you're recording live. Okay, if you're recording live,
then you go to the recording
stage. And so you've got to make sure your music is orchestrated properly. You might do that yourself, or you might hire an orchestrator.
Mm-hmm.
After it's orchestrated, you got to make sure the musicians get the parts. So you hire a copyist, or you do that yourself.
Is big.
And when you do that, you actually have to get all the notes into a program that will spit out the scores and the parts. Those programs are Finale and Sibelius in most cases. Sometimes people use Logic or other programs because they're capable of it, but they're not as good.
Yeah.
And so then they get the parts to every musician. On the recording stage, you have the engineers recording it, if you're recording at a big stage, or if you're at home, it might just be you. And then you've got all the musicians. Then you've got the conductor, who could be you, or it could be somebody you hire as conductor.
Good reasons for both, by the way. We could come back to that.
Yeah, we're just going to name all the possible jobs that happen along the way.
Both of those are good possibilities, though, for different reasons.
You record it, then you have to have it mixed. A lot of times, again, all these jobs, usually, when you're first starting out, you do every single one of them. So, like, I've done every one of these jobs. I'm sure Alex has to. Then you mix the music.
I haven't had someone else do those jobs. it's only been me.
Very rarely. Hey, what's up? Hey, dude. You know, very rarely you get to hire somebody, but when you have a bigger budget, you do. Then you hire somebody to mix it.
Mm-hmm.
In a perfect world, master it. Sometimes a different person.
Yeah.
Then you take that finished product and you go to the dub stage where you are with the director and the producers and everybody, and you actually mix it to the sound, to the picture, and make sure it
dialogue sounds
in one of those cool rooms with the movie theater,
and it's just one element of the
they
many.
Are so cool.
Oh, it's all you've got a screen that's the size of the entire room.
Yep.
Just like you're at a movie theater, but you're sitting
there.
It's a movie theater
with a console.
Yeah, yeah. And you're sitting there telling them the music should be this loud or this soft amongst all the other people that want their stuff to be a certain level too, and you're just, you know, having a dialogue to figure out what level everything should be.
Have a punching fight with the sound designer.
Most of the times, you just have to go away.
Right, right.
And there's actually
Bye, Kyle.
Yeah, you will usually lose. By the way, most times you lose.
But no, if you have a really good mixing team, they know the perfect levels to make everything, and usually you're so biased at that point about your music that it's better if somebody else decides.
We should insert into this whole process. Hopefully, you've been working with the sound team so that you avoid any arguments. Like, you know, if there's like.
If it's a race car movie, you'd be careful about whatever the pitch of the race car is for the entire movie.
Or, well, no, you're going to ride around that. And then, like, the sound designers generally have, they have pretty free range, and then you have to, you know, ride around what they're doing. And, like, you know, if there's a bunch of bullets flying and there's explosions, those are going to cover up many musical elements. And so you're going to maybe try and ride around that. But, again, that's totally in a perfect world, and that doesn't always happen.
Right on.
But that is another part of the process.
But those are all in a real quick nutshell. Like that's what goes on from getting. I probably missed like 25 jobs in the middle there, you know. But basically,
that's the good bird's eye view.
Those are all the if you have a small budget, it's basically you sitting in your room making sure everything sounds perfect, and then the dub stage is usually going to
someone else's room.
Usually the sound designer's studio apartment and mixing it. You know what I mean?
Right.
But the more they allocate for each part of the budget, the more you get to sort of elaborate on every part of that. And in a perfect scenario, even on a small budget film, if you do everything yourself and you get to bring it to a cool sound stage and mix it with the film, it's still really cool to collaborate. I think you get to collaborate. The bigger the budget, you get to collaborate more, basically.
Yes.
Which is nice.
And
because
delegate
it gets,
more.
It gets kind of... You know, boring sitting by yourself.
And am I the only one in the mood to go to a recording session right now? Like, does anyone else got like no. that sort of like, yeah, let's do that. Let's go right now.
they're pretty great.
Damn, man.
They definitely are.
Well, it's just a hell of a process. And this was like the little Cliff Notes version of it. But I kind of want to sit down and record the next 5 episodes of this podcast right now. Oh, man, I'm so psyched for this show. Anyway, so cool. Let's call that a wrap on this episode. And we'll, you know, the bird's eye view of what this whole film scoring process is and what it looks like. And in episodes to come, we're going to talk about all the little specifics and conversations about composers and favorite scores and the Oscars for the scores this year and every damn thing we want to talk about. I'm so psyched to finally have a music podcast, and I'm so glad you guys are on it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, man.
Cool. So in that case, let's wrap this thing up. You can always find episodes from the Friends in Your Head Network at friendsinyourhead.com. Go to the forum. It's a wonderful community of people, and it's growing every single week. There'll be a conversation thread for this episode, as well as new episodes that come out in the future, and you can talk music or talk podcasts or, I don't know, talk whatever you want on the forum, man. We don't have any rules. It's the frontier out there. Anyway, buy our shirts. We don't get much money, but they're good shirts. There's a big PayPal button on the website. We're not asking, we're just saying. Holden Hill designed and maintained the website. And until next time we talk to you, my name has been Teague Christie.
Alex Smith.
Kyle Newmaster.
And this has been Uncomposed. Thank you very much for listening. Good night.